Now, Woody Woodmansey this time round. He's in Dublin, of course, this weekend for all that as well. The Bowie stuff. David Bowie died 4 years ago yesterday. He's the last surviving member of the Ziggy Stardust studio band. And he was on all the big albums, as in the drummer on The Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, Loud and Insane, etc. So let's just jump into the interview here and see what happens. When it came to the albums after The Man Who Sold the World, you know, the famous the Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust and Loud and Insane and all that, that The Man Who Sold the World itself is brilliant, but it's somewhat overlooked, isn't it?
That's exactly it, really. I mean, that was the first album that Mick Ronson and myself did with David, and Tony Visconti was on bass. And we'd kind of come out of the progressive rock thing that we were in. So that kind of sound and style and way of playing got onto that album. And it's an album we really enjoyed. You know, we really enjoyed creating it. And Bowie was going through a management change at the time, so we'd finished the album, and then he was going to Tony DeFreeze, who became his manager. There was no record deal, and there was no money at that time, so we couldn't actually go out on the road. I think we were on about £7 a week at that time, which was just enough to pay rent and just about eat. So it's an album we were really looking forward at the time to getting out playing in front of audiences, because some of the concepts were very strange and weird, and the playing was almost metal, you know, at times. But we never got to do it. We did do a couple in the Ziggy show with Bowie from that album, but we never did the complete album. And I think probably it was probably what didn't help it was there was the management change, which didn't help it. The no record deal thing didn't help. And probably David wearing a dress on the front of a heavy metal album didn't help it either. I could never imagine a Led Zeppelin fan with that album under his arm, you know.
No, probably not. Certainly not at the time. Well, let's just take a look at the time then. I mean, how did you get to work with David Bowie? Was it a musician's wanted ad, or did you just know and hear that this guy, David Bowie, wanted some musicians? Because let's face it, he might have had Space Oddity as a hit single. Loads of people had hit singles and were never heard from again. So his name didn't necessarily mean an awful lot when you came to work with him first.
No, it didn't. I mean, it didn't mean anything to me either. I'd seen one flyer at an open-air concert in the north of England, and it had a picture of him with his curly hair, and he was playing an acoustic guitar. So he was really, to me, he was a folk singer. And, Mick Ronson and myself were in, like, blues, hard rock, progressive rock stuff. That was kind of our direction. So we never really listened to any folk. So I didn't even notice Space Oddity at the time. And then Mick got the drummer I'd replaced in that band with, Mick Ronson, kind of left Hull and went down south to join David.
Yeah.
And I guess he was trying to make the move from being an acoustic guitar folky to a rock band.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you were
in
a band.
It wasn't happening, basically.
No.
They didn't like the guitarist they were using, and so the drummer said, well, I know this guitarist in Hull called Mick Ronson, who was really, hot. So Mick went down, and then a few months later, I replaced that drummer again. David phoned up and said, Mick says you're really good. I want you to come and live with us in Beckenham and be part of the band.
Okay, well, living in Beckenham now is one thing, but before that, just like, that's a choice that you have to make. You're working in a lenses factory, 9 to 5, you're making money, it's pretty cool. By the end of the week, you get a nice paycheck, a lot better than if you were, messing around in bands. Even though it was nice to be in bands, you're in a band called The Rats, all the rest of it, etc. Was it a case of, God, what if I don't take this chance? What if I don't do this? Oh, to hell with it, I'll throw it all in, and I'll throw my sort of whole future in with this guy called David Bowie.
It was. I'd kind of got kicked out of school. My parents and my relations look. I was the black sheep of the family because of that. You know, you look at my school reports and it says this kid will go far, and I never did. And so I always got the the teacher said you would always do really well, but you haven't, and I'd been sacked from a few jobs. I'd started working in this lenses factory. I'd got promoted, and I wasn't really after that. It was just a job to get some money so you could go out on a weekend and play and whatever. And then I got promoted, and they said, you'd need to let us know on the Monday morning. And that same weekend, I got a call from Bowie. So my parents were all, you know, fantastic, because it was a pretty good job I was offered. You're going to have holiday pay and a car, and we'll get a house and all the rest of it. So I sat in all the weekend going, what am I going to do? Do I go for this thing in London and go professional as a musician, or do I take this job that's a good job? And I couldn't get there. I could not get a decision. And I was watching, the TV was on in the room, and a band came on. And for some reason, I was thinking I'm 70 years old. And I look at this, and I've got my grandkids there all around me. and I say to one of my grandkids, now this is all in my head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just went, you know, when I was 18, I could have, whoa, and a big shiver just went through me.
Right, so straight to London.
Yeah, and I just went, whoa, that's it.
Okay,
yeah.
So what you did was you went for it, and you went to something that was completely alien to you in so many ways, because basically it was a post-hippie kind of commune kind of place in some ways. Like, we're talking about this gothic house in London where lots of strange things happened. Like, the first time you met David Bowie, for instance, the first thing that struck you was just how thin he was, etc. But, like, he might have had his hit single with Space Oddity, but that was, like, even a little bit before that. So he wasn't necessarily anything, but he was certainly going somewhere. Did you see from the word go, in terms of the piano in one room, you guys sleeping in the landing in sleeping bags and all the rest, that whatever it was that stuck you to this place, that made you stay there, was there was something about David Bowie? You could see that he was on the cusp of something, whatever about you, and you weren't going to sort of say no to this wave.
Yeah, it was really the, you know, that he got dressed as a rock star for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this guy means it, and he kind of taught us, well, you've got to be it before you do it. You've got to believe that that's what you are before you can do it.
And he really did
that.
That was
a big change, you know. And then you saw that, and you saw the, and then he would play songs to us, and then you'd go, this guy can write. And he had ideas. Yeah, they were weird, and they were not the norm that were around at the time. But there was something just about the songs and about him performing them to you that you just went, this is good. This is worth backing.
Woody, if David was in charge, is it fair to say that Angie Bowie was the gaffer in some way? She's the one that gave you the 10 quid at the end of the week, or less than that.
Yeah, that's probably true. It was 7 quid. But yeah, it would be Angie. I mean, unfortunately, Angie couldn't cook, so we kind of had to, you know, we had a lot of fights about the food. Because I think he'd still got some money from the Space Oddity days.
Yeah.
But he didn't give that to us, obviously. So we just got a pittance at that time. If Angie went shopping, she'd come back with all these luxury items that would last you one day. Well, we were starving, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And, like, in one way, though, is it fair to say that, like, you know, this was such a culture shock for you, such a world was opening in so many different ways that you've realised you kind of had to go with this? I mean, one day you wake up and there's 12 naked models in the place. He brings you to a place called Sombrero, which is the gay club in London. This is all... And he's wearing a woman's dress all the time. He does all these interviews when you go to America wearing a woman's dress. Like, this was all completely alien to you, and you realise there's something happening here. You don't know what it is, but it's cool.
Yeah, exactly that. I guess it pulls out the artist in you. You see the effect. You see the presentation of the music, whereas not many people bothered about how to present it. You know, I mean, he did take us to theatres and ballets, and he said, "No, don't watch the ballet or the play.
What's the lighting and the choreography?
Watch the lights." And you went, "Oh, cool!" And you wouldn't have noticed that. He gradually, I guess, educated us so we were all on the same page in the end, you know. And then you could throw ideas in that weren't stupid.
And when you went to the States, I mean, did he genuinely at some stage have like a platoon of bodyguards just to fool people into thinking that he was a megastar, which of course he wasn't?
Yeah, we had the guy that lived downstairs at in Beckenham, and the roadie that we'd had in the Rats in Yorkshire, Stewie George, was the other bodyguard, and they looked mean. I mean, we kind of needed it, because when we first went out on the road, they would throw things. Do you know what I mean? They would throw like bottles and beer mats and all sorts of objects because of the way we looked, and we had to, we had to stop touring at first because it was dangerous.
And like, also, I mean, like, David's role models would include everybody from James Dean to Marilyn Monroe, who died early. So one time he was confronted on a New York street by a man with a gun. Were you there with that, and did it freak him out? Like, was he afraid at one stage of, some kind of a paranoia thing of being shot by a fan?
Yeah, he was into that. I mean, we'd do some gigs and he was terrified before going on, especially if there was a royal box close to the stage. Mm. He would want to know who was in it, were they cool people? So that was going on all the time,
Speaking of a royal box close to the stage, some years back at the Olympia Theatre in Dublin, I was in a box there looking at David Bowie on stage, and a man, his wife, was in a box next door to me. Were you at that gig in a box?
I was.
Yeah, I thought so. And was that one of the few times you've met David since and, talked to him?
Yeah, it is, actually. We were. I was touring with Joe Elliott and Phil
Collen
from
Def Leppard.
Yeah, and they got us. Bowie's office rang up and said, "Do you want tickets for the gig tonight?" And we said, "Yeah, yeah." So that was the first time three of the band had actually been in the same room since we split up. Wow. And he walked on, looked up. He knew we were up there, so he looked up to the box and gave us a nod, and we nodded him back. I think it was a bit like the old men in
Statler and Waldorf right. Oh God,
like
yeah, right, okay. Okay, well, we're talking about the split happened in July 73. Everybody knows about that, the Hammersmith Odeon, etc. When it did happen on stage, and he says that's the end of this tour and it's the end of the Spiders from Mars, you didn't really know about that until that announcement on the stage, whereas Mick Ronson did you feel as though, regardless of whatever, and it's all water under the bridge in so many ways, but David was what he was, but he could be a bit, let's put it this, not very loyal, a bit cold, a bit brutal with a statement like that.
Well, looking back, that was very brutal.
Mm.
I guess at that exact moment in time, and I threw a drumstick at his head because I didn't like the announcement anyway, and they cut that out of the film, I think.
Right.
But because he did very much create effects on the spur of the moment, whatever he felt like doing to create an effect, he would do it or say it. So you got used to that way of operating with him. So you didn't know if that was just a publicity stunt for that night.
Yeah, exactly,
So it didn't really sink in, really, until later on,
Like, if you think of the Ziggy Stardust album, you are one of the Spiders from Mars. Did you know that you were a spider from Mars and had to wear this and had to wear that and look like this? Because you weren't really the kind of guy, coming from your musical background, that really would have felt very comfortable wearing that stuff and saying, wait, what am I? I'm a spider from Mars?
Yeah, the whole Ziggy thing, really, it was not a... It was not really a concept album with a band and all the rest of it right from the beginning.
Mm.
It was a gradual thing. The presentation was when it really, the culture shock really hit, when he said, "I've got these three coloured outfits. Oh, this is what I want to have made." And we would end up walking around Liberty's and Dickens and Jones's in London with Angie and him, looking for material, going, "Rock and roll, this is not rock and roll, not our version of rock and roll." And then he would say, "I want you to wear this." And that took a bit of persuading, I must admit.
Having said that, rock and roll was changing so much in so many different directions that you might as well go on the big one, in this big one that's happening. When we think about the albums that you're on, you're on the big four David Bowie albums. There's The Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane.
Okay, hold on a second. We leave it there for just a second or two, because I want to just play a little bit more of that interview. We did say a Bowie special for the hour. This is from interviews from a few years ago. This is Tony Visconti as in producer, Woody Woodmansey is who we're talking about here, as in drummer and all the big David Bowie albums, The Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, Lad and Zane, as we just mentioned. And don't forget, they're playing tonight at the Olympia Theatre in Dublin. Holy Holy is the band. Then tomorrow it's the Royal College of Surgeons where they're speaking there. But I think I'll go back into that. Before I do, I might as well play the album that's really being celebrated this week in Ireland for Bowie Week, or in Dublin for Bowie Week, I should say. And give you a little blast of this one here. Play this for Mark Carter, listening at the moment, having a cup of coffee on the Costa del Sol. It's an album that you can lose yourself in. I mean, obviously, to me, Hunky Dory is the best one, which was the next album. But it's just that The Man Who Sold the World, it's this totalitarian machine, annihilation, futuristic dystopian, all these kind of words. Did you even realise just how dark the album was lyrically at the time? Or was it just, hey, we're just doing what David wants us to do here, let's see if we can play it?
No, I mean, we'd, you know, both Mick and I were into sci-fi, reading sci-fi. So,
right.
So, it, you know, we were kind of open to that. And, yeah, it was, we knew it was dark. You know, when you're singing about somebody in a mental institution and then somebody else who's still got a gun and he's taking pot shots at people in the city, you know, then it was exciting. And I guess you always... you're in that position where you go, you either go with this, knowing that it's, there's always that chance it can really go, because it's different, because it's emotional and all the rest of it, or it might be totally an unwanted thing and then you kill your career off.
Of course, yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was the same in probably every album we did, felt like that. You were like, are you just sticking your neck out and your career out here? And I think it was the same for Bowie. It was, you know, he tried so many times to make it with different styles and different songs. And, you know, this one, I think he first started to write what he wanted to write as opposed to what was out there already.
Sure,
selling.
Yeah.
So that gave it more... I think an artist has to do that. Like, what do you feel? Not just write a boy meets girl song because they always sell, but what do you want to
say? Of course, yeah.
And I don't think Bowie ever wrote a boy meets girl song ever, you know.
The funny thing is, when you think of The Man Who Sold the World, like, I mean, it's just, in fact, the title track, do you find it just ironic? If I was to tell you now, I'm sure you know the people, half the world thinks Kurt Cobain wrote the song.
Yeah, I read that somewhere, which is, I think it pissed Bowie off as well.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, like, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Yeah. Why did you do a Nirvana song, yeah?
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. Okay, just one thing of just about the, like, the end of you with as a spider from Mars, up to Aladdin saying that. Did you actually get sacked as such from the band, if you like, or told, we don't want you anymore, on the day of your wedding?
Yes, I did.
Wow. He was supposed to go, David, and he didn't go, and he had told your wife-to-be, and now your wife, that he would go.
Yeah, that's right.
And were you annoyed about that?
Very.
Yeah.
Very, very at the time. In fact, his manager rang me 10 minutes after we'd done the ceremony. So it was kind of the first call in after you've just got married.
When you say his manager, who was that?
Tony DeFries.
Ah, so it was Tony DeFries then and it was Tony DeFries before. I would get the impression that Tony DeFries to you was a bit of a brick wall. You could have done without him.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I'd run across, I'd had big arguments with him on the last American tour and that.
Yeah.
Because his viewpoint was, you know, I'd rather pay the road crew more money because they're worth more than the band.
Yeah, right, okay, well, that kind of sums it up all right, yeah?
Yeah, so that's where the...
I mean, did you feel at any point that you guys, particularly back in that house where you were all growing up together and, I mean, making music together and you realised just how good he was, the piano there, the guitar, getting songs together, etc. Did you think in any way that you were kind of a family, but you realised really that David could be kind of spiteful and with Tony DeFries, you didn't stand a chance?
I guess it was pretty much like a family. But I have to say, you know, I mean, you know, Bowie was always the leader.
Yeah, of course.
And I think he found it hard, to be honest. You know, he found it hard playing the part of Ziggy Stardust. It was a successful role and it was powerful on stage with the band and with him. But when he could not take that off and be David Jones, Then it got a bit hairy.
Then
it got a bit hairy for him.
So did he really get locked in a kind of a Ziggy world? I mean, I've spoken to David a few times in this very programme, and one time he told me that one of the most embarrassing things he ever did was he went to an Elvis Presley show dressed as Ziggy Stardust, and he had to walk up through the crowd and get into his seat. He knows Elvis saw him. He said he wished the ground had swallowed him up. He said, that was a step too far. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, he couldn't take it off. It kind of took a hold. I mean, I guess, you know, I guess to be able to go on stage and do that and then walk off and pop back home and watch TV, that would be all right. But he actually had to do interviews. He then had to do TV things and blah, blah. So he never, and they didn't want to talk to David Jones or David Bowie.
Of course not. They wanted to talk to Ziggy.
Yeah. So he never took it off. And then, you know, I would say things to him. I'd say, did you see that film last night, David? And he'd just look at me with the Ziggy look. And I'd think, he didn't hear me. I'd say it again. And he'd still just look straight at me.
You should have said, did you see that movie on TV last night, Ziggy? He might have heard you then.
Yeah,
all right.
Okay, we leave it at that. That's enough of it. I think that's Bowie Week happening tonight, Olympia Theatre. Woody Woodmansey there, as in Spiders from Mars, and Tony Visconti on stage, Holy Holy. And then tomorrow, it's the Royal College of Surgeons, the two of them talking.